Pijanavalapa Girivara Dhari. Pijanavalapa Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Raja Janaranjana. Yashoda Nandana Raja Janaranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Bhairajakacharya Stotara Sattva Sri Sri Madhya Divine Grace Isi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada Ki Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Gyana Tivarandasya Ginanjana Shulakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam Pancha Kopatarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasari Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay, we're reading from 7th Canto, Chapter 8, Text 19, and we'll go to 24. Okay, we'll do, I guess, there's like a half a verse, and then this is, the first two lines are a half a verse, which is like the whole verse in and of itself, and then the second two lines are half of another verse, it seems. So I guess we'll chant this. Mimang samanasya samu. Tito grato. Nisinga rupastada lambayanakam. Pratapta chami karak chandalochanam. Spuratsata keshara drimbitananam. Mimang samanasya samutito gato. Risingam pastadadam vayanakam. Pratapta chami ikara chandalochanam. Rasata keshara dvimbidhanam. Mimam Samana Sya Samotito Gato Nrisinga Rupas Tadalam Bayanakam Pratapta Chami Karachanda Lochanam Spurata Keshada Jimbitananam Mingman Samana Sya Samutito Gato Navrupas Tadalam Bayanakam Pratapta Chami Karakan Chanam I'll just continue reading the rest of the Sanskrit. Karala dangstram karavala chanchala kshuranta jivam prukuti mukulbanam stad hordva karnam giricha kandaradbhuta vyatas janasam hanubedabhishanam divis prasad Kayamadir kapapi vara grivor vakshastalam alpa madhyamam chandram sugorash churitam tanuru hair vishvag bujani kashatam nakayudham durasadham sarva nichetara yudha praveka vidravita daita danavam. Yeah, this is a pretty long word for word, so I might just skip it. We'll go right to the translation. Hiranyakashipu studied the form of the Lord, trying to decide who the form of Nrisimhadev standing before him was. The Lord's form was extremely fearsome because of his angry eyes, which resembled molten gold. His shining mane, which expanded the dimensions of his fearful face, his deadly teeth, and his razor-sharp tongue, which moved about like a dueling sword. His ears were erect and motionless, and his nostrils and gaping mouth appeared like caves of a mountain. His jaws parted fearfully, and his entire body touched the sky. His neck was very short and thick, his chest broad, his waist thin, and the hairs on his body as white as the rays of the moon. His arms, which resembled flanks of soldiers, spread in all directions as he killed the demons, rogues, and atheists with his conch shell, disc, club, lotus, and other natural weapons. So these kind of descriptions are so cool. you don't really find these types of descriptions hardly anywhere else about God, what he looks like, and all these very, you know, a lot of details. It just kind of inspires this interest to want to learn more. Especially if you heard this for the first time, it'd be like really interesting. But even if you keep hearing it, it's nice. Go to the next verse, text 23. Prayena meyam harino rumayina vadhas mrito yetnena samudyatena kim evam brumams tva bhyapyatar kadayudho nadan risham risingham patidayita kunjara. Hiranyakashipu murmured to himself, Lord Vishnu, who possesses great mystic power, has made this plan to kill me, but what is the use of such an attempt? Who can fight with me? Thinking like this and taking up his club, Hiranyakashipu attacked the Lord like an elephant. Purport. In the jungle, there are sometimes fights between lions and elephants. Here the Lord appeared like a lion, and Hiranyakashipu, unafraid of the Lord, attacked him like an elephant. Generally, the elephant is defeated by the lion, and therefore the comparison in this verse is appropriate. So anyone ever see elephants and lions go at it? Oh, yeah. A couple times. So apparently I was watching some videos about lions and tigers, lions and elephants interacting with each other. So the way it works is that the lions, they try to go after the baby elephants. And that's their food, I guess. But they don't go after the big elephants because the big elephants, you know, might do something to the lions because they're pretty big. But the baby ones they can handle. So, but the lions are not at all afraid of elephants, even though they're so huge. They're not at all afraid. So sometimes the big elephant, the adult elephants, they'll try to, you know, kind of charge at the lions to try to get them to go away so that they can protect their young. So then they'll, you know, they'll run and they'll try to, you know, chase the elephants or the lions away. But the lions, they don't take this charge so seriously. They just kind of, you know, they look totally peaceful as they're just kind of, you know, running away from the lion a little bit, but they're not like scared at all. You know, it looks like they're just kind of taunting and having a good time as they're, you know, playing around with the elephants. So I guess Hiranyakashipu is compared to like one of those elephants who's trying to go after the tiger, and the tiger's just not fazed by that. Okay. So we'll go on to the next verse. Lakshito gyao patita patangamo eta nrsanghajasi so surastada natad vichitram kalusatva damani svadejasayo nupurapitapat tamaha. Translation: just as a small insect falls forcefully into a fire, and the insignificant creature becomes invisible. When Hiranyakashipu attacked the Lord, who was full of effulgence, Hiranyakashipu became invisible. This is not at all astonishing, for the Lord is always situated in pure goodness. Formerly, during creation, he entered the dark universe and illuminated it by his spiritual effulgence. Purport: the Lord is situated transcendentally in pure goodness. The material world is generally controlled by tamogun, the quality of ignorance, but the spiritual world, because of the presence of the Lord and his effulgence, is free from all contamination by darkness, passion, or contaminated goodness. Although there is a tinge of goodness in this material world in terms of the brahminical qualifications, such qualifications sometimes become invisible because of the strong prevalence of the modes of passion and ignorance. But because the Lord is always transcendentally situated, the material modes of passion and ignorance cannot touch him. Whenever the Lord is present, there cannot be any darkness from the mode of ignorance. It is stated in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Surya Samo Mayahaya Andhakara Yahan Krishna Tahanahi Mayara Adhikara. Godhead is light, nescience is darkness. Where there is Godhead, there is no nescience. This material world is full of darkness and ignorance of spiritual life, but by bhakti yoga, this ignorance is dissipated. The Lord appeared because of the bhakti yoga exhibited by Prahlad Maharaj. And as soon as the Lord appeared, the influence of Hiranyakashipu's passion and ignorance was vanquished, as the Lord's quality of pure goodness or the Brahman effulgence, became prominent. In that prominent effulgence, Hiranyakashipu became invisible, or his influence became insignificant. An example illustrating how the darkness of the material world is vanquished is given in the Shastra. When Brahma was created from the lotus stem growing from the abdomen of Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, Lord Brahma saw everything to be dark. But when he received knowledge from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, everything became clear, as everything becomes clear when one comes from night to sunshine. The important point is that as long as we are in the material modes of nature, we are always in darkness. This darkness cannot be dissipated without the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which is invoked by the practice of Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga creates a transcendental situation with no tinges of material contamination. So, the verse is saying that when Hiranyakashipu tried to attack Nrisingadev, because of Nrisingadev's effulgence, when Hiranyakashipu came to try to attack Nrisingadev, he just kind of disappeared, or, you know, kind of got, he looked very insignificant compared to the wonderfully effulgent Nrisingadev. So like a fly entering into a fire or something. So in the purport, Prabhupada quotes Chaitanya Charitamrita, where the Lord is compared to light, and nescience is darkness. Where there is Godhead, there is no nescience. So it's a very nice idea. Or, I mean, like, it's a popular, it's the way it is, but it's a popular idea. Generally, when I think of, like, light and darkness, good and evil, you know, these kind of things, my mind goes to these, like, Lord of the Rings type movies. And I don't know if anybody's ever seen The Hobbit, but that's another one that I saw not too long ago. And it just kind of, like, portrays this idea of light and darkness very starkly in a very artistic kind of a way. So, you know, I was just thinking of, like, if you've seen it, like, you know, Gandalf, he's like compared to light. You know, he's like this good wizard, and he's fighting evil, this thing of darkness. This is how it's portrayed in the movies. So, in one of the Hobbit movies, Gandalf, he goes to this place which appears to be abandoned. Appears to be abandoned, but this apparently is the place where darkness is rising. You know, so by the nods, a lot of people have seen this movie, apparently. Anyway, these movies aren't so bad because they remind you of, like, they're like the European attempt at trying to replicate the Mahabharata or the Ramayana or something like that. I'm not advocating watching them or anything, but if you had already watched them, then you can kind of see how there's a lot of comparisons. One devotee he made a commentary on the Hobbit versus and the Mahabharata and Ramayana, how those kind of related. And apparently the author of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings in general, Tolkien, I guess, he was very fascinated by Indian mythology. And he thought that the European mythology was not so good. It wasn't, like, up to par with Indian mythology. So anyway, he wanted to, like, kind of create some nice story from, like, the European perspective, like epic story, kind of like that. So anyway, so when Gandalf was was because he was like this. I mean, the comparison doesn't perfectly work, but he's kind of he's compared to like this goodness character. I don't know about pure goodness, but certainly some high level of light, something. He's like the spiritual master, and he's going into this place which is considered to be total darkness. You know, like very haunted, like darkness is rising and it's just dark. So then when he goes up into this place, he starts chanting these mantras, and then the environment kind of like, well, it reveals it. I mean, it becomes revealed. The light reveals what's actually going on in this place. It looked as if there was nothing going on in this deserted castle fort thing. But when he went in there and chanted his mantras, light came, and then he was revealed. All the darkness and everything that was there, all the rallying of the, you know, the evil orcs and the goblins and the whatever, they were all there, like rallying for big war. So then there was like this epitome of darkness being, if you've seen it in this movie, which Sauron. So then he tries to attack the Gandalf, you know, maybe similar to the way Hiranyakashipu was attacking the Sringadev, maybe. And then what Gandalf does is he puts this like force field, this like white force field around him, and the darkness cannot penetrate because Gandalf has this impenetrably light force field kind of a thing. Of course, this analogy doesn't work perfectly because I don't know if Gandalf is in pure goodness. Because if he were in pure goodness, he might be like Prahlad Maharaj and not affected at all. But if you've seen the movie, what happens is that darkness overpowers Gandalf and he ends up being, you know, put in a cage somewhere and kind of captured. What's that? Like a Gyani or Yogi. Yeah, Yogi, I think, because he has mystic powers. But Gandalf is kind of like goodness, and the thing is, goodness, passion, and ignorance are always competing against each other. So, and in the material world, goodness often loses compared to ignorance and passion. So it seems like darkness is stronger. Like if you're just looking at it from the material perspective, it almost seems like darkness is stronger, especially here in Kali Yuga. So if you were like put a bet on who's going to win, anyway, this is another mundane example. But I remember when I used to watch South Park. Not the most mode of goodness type of a thing to quote, but one of the examples in this cartoon was that they had Jesus versus the devil. I don't know if you remember that episode. You know, in like a box, in like a fight, and then there was like this, you know, the devil looked like this huge, you know, monster was about ready to tear up everything. And then Jesus was this little stick, thin, looks like he can't do anything, kind of a figure. And then there was advertised, there was like this big, huge event. Oh, Jesus versus the devil, they're going to fight. And, you know, so then all these people were placing best bets on who was going to win. And then everybody bet on the devil winning because he seemed he was very, very strong. The Jesus ended up winning, but because the devil bet on Jesus winning, because the devil knew that everyone would bet on him winning, so then he cashed in on everybody's. Anyway, so anyway, but the point is, back to this idea, is that these modes of nature are always competing against each other, and right now it seems like the mode of passion and ignorance is having the upper hand over goodness, because that's the way it works. It's not necessarily that goodness is always better than passion and ignorance, or stronger than passion and ignorance. But it is always the case that pure goodness is always stronger than passion and ignorance. Because pure goodness, when it goes into a place where there's full of passion and ignorance, it doesn't get influenced by that passion and ignorance like Hiranyakashipu, or like Nisringadev being pure goodness and Hiranyakashipu coming and trying to attack him, it doesn't influence him at all, or Prahlad Maharaj for that matter. So then, we are in we are in darkness, ignorance, you know, so it's like we can kind of relate this with our own lives. We can say that we're the ones who are kind of in darkness, in ignorance, and we want to go to the light. We want to go to pure goodness. So how does that happen? How did that happen for Hiranyakashipu? He got killed. Sringadev killed him. So that was how Sringadev brought Hiranyakashipu from his darkness to light. You know, then he became liberated and all that stuff. So it's kind of how that happened. How does that happen for us? Yeah, we kill our demoniac mentality with Shravanam, Kirtanam, Sadhu Sangha. And particularly in this verse, the example of the light, you know, because God appears in so many different ways to help bring living entities up from darkness and ignorance. So back in Satya Yuga, he used to come and then just, you know, clean house, kill people, and that was his way of bringing people out of darkness and ignorance. But in this age, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam, 1.3.43, where it says that the Srimad Bhagavatam is compared to light, is like the sun, and it appeared just after the disappearance of Krishna. You know, when Krishna appeared, religion and knowledge and so many other things disappeared, but then the Srimad Bhagavatam appeared just like the sun. And for all those people who are, you know, kind of in darkness, or their vision is in darkness about the absolute truth or something, people will get light and knowledge and wisdom from this Bhagavat Purana. So if anyone's ever seen that painting, anyone see the painting of who's holding? Somebody's like when Vyasadeva is holding the Bhagavatam, and the Bhagavatam is like this light about, you know, this light coming out and it's spreading on the dark world of, you know, who's very influenced by passion and ignorance. And so it's a really nice picture. I remember, you know, it's one of these kind of like, and it just makes you interested. What's that big light, you know, and then we can that's how we can get out of this darkness we're in, is by the shastras, particularly the Srimad Bhagavatam. And that's what we heard an interesting description about what the Vedas are. The Vedas are this, and the example, because it ties in with this example of, because Lord Brahma, he was in darkness. He was in ignorance. So how did he get out of ignorance? So the Lord, Hiranyakashipu got out of ignorance by being killed by the Lord. We get out of ignorance by the Bhagavatam. So how did Lord Brahma get out of ignorance? Yeah. You know, because it's saying that when, you know, he was in this place, it was totally darkness, he was confused, he didn't know what to do, it was just dark. And he engaged in austerity, but he got out of, that's right, but before that he heard tapa or whatever from, and it was Vishnu. Basically, he heard directly from Vishnu in his heart. So the Lord kind of helped him get out of ignorance by directly speaking to him in the heart, whereas he helps us get out of ignorance by the Bhagavatam or devotees. But with Lord Brahma, is direct, speaking to him in the heart. And then we heard a nice description that when Lord Brahma, he tries to put what he heard from Vishnu gave him all knowledge, you know, gave him all knowledge, everything that he needs to know about Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, And everything was given to Lord Brahma in terms of knowledge. So when Lord Brahma, he tries to put that into words and then give it to other people, that is known as the Vedas. You know, because he then passes it down and then it gets turned into the Vedas. And that's kind of how language is formed, so we hear it. So, I was just going to say some things from the class we heard on Sunday, because it kind of relates. Because the point here is that knowledge is the thing that brings us out of darkness. We're in darkness now, we're in ignorance, and knowledge is the thing that helps us get out of darkness. So, because being in darkness is very difficult. It's very difficult to get out of darkness, especially on your own. Because we heard a nice analysis about the problems of being in darkness, is that everybody has these four flaws. You know, there's like this perceptual ineptness, or, you know, basically our senses are, we have imperfect senses, and we can't experience, we can't know things so well with our imperfect senses because they're just limited. You know, not just our senses of like nose and eyes and ears and things like that. Those are just like instruments. But also the inner sense in the mind, these are very limited in what they can, and how they can process information, how we can understand things. It's just, we can't know very much. And they're just very limited. So then having not so nice senses leads to misconceptions. So with misconceptions, we have limited senses and, you know, we might have misperceptions about things. So we'll see a rope and we think, oh, that's a snake. So it's just a misperception. We misperceived it because our senses are not perfect. And that's not necessarily such a bad thing, but it gets worse when it goes to the other two flaws that people have, is that it leads to people being deluded. So deluded is the next flaw. And when you're deluded, that means that you might have a misperception about something, but you don't try to correct it. Or you kind of really believe in that misperception and you take it as truth, and therefore you become deluded. So if you see a rope and it's really a snake or something or vice versa, then if you believe that rope is a snake and you're so convinced about it, then you're deluded and you don't try to do anything to correct that misperception. And then misconception then leads to, or misperception leads to delusion. Delusion then leads to dishonesty. So we're cheaters, you know, you have this cheating propensity. So now let's say so someone shows us that, no, this thing is really a snake. Look at the teeth. It can bite you. It can kill you. But we just are so, I don't know, we're so embarrassed to the fact that we were wrong, that we just kind of make up lies and say, and we just say, no, let's just forget those little details you showed me about the fangs and stuff. That's really just a rope. And then you go around telling people that's a rope or something, even though it's been shown to you clearly that, you know, it's not a rope, or it's not a snake, not a rope. So now we have these four defects, and then the whole way in which we can go about knowing things, there's, there's pratyaksha, anumana, and sabda. So, you know, so we can't know things. Our instruments by which we can know things are very limited, so pratyaksha is not so great, although it's useful for some things. And anumana, our ability to process and analyze and make predictions and stuff, also good but not so perfect. So then shabda is there, and that's what we're trying to get from. That is like the light here. That is the light in comparison in this verse. It's shabda. It's knowledge. It's that which can help us get out of darkness. So then our process is the, if we try to do this on our own, try to come to light or knowledge on our own, that's like kind of going through the ascending process. You know, a lot of the scientific methods nowadays, they use the scientific process to come to some kind of knowledge. And that's okay for some knowledge, but it won't give you perfect knowledge. Whereas the descending process, you know, where the knowledge is there somehow, this knowledge is perfect and it's been given to you, then there's a possibility of there getting perfect knowledge. So, that's kind of how we can try to take advantage of this light that is there, this knowledge that is there. We put our effort into practicing bhakti yoga, and then hopefully light will come in our life and we'll get out of darkness. Okay, is there anything anybody would like to add to this discussion?
Dave. Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. You made some really good points, especially about the hobby. That was really nice. Actually, I all these movies reminded me of, especially Peter Pan. I won't last too long on that, but they kind of remind me of Krishna consciousness. And you could see in everything, every day in life, everything's kind of like a reflection of the spiritual world in some way or another, either darkness or light. So when I read Krishna consciousness, I kind of always think about those movies because I already watched them, you know, so it's not like I can't get rid of those impressions. But you were making a point that, I'll try to relate this to the class. You were saying we were cheaters, and it was just going to go along to the point that I was already going to make, because in this verse, one of Krishna's incarnations, of course, this is kind of loud. Can you turn it down a little bit? Is that possible? Lord Nrisimhadev is one of his incarnations. This is mentioned. Of course, he has many incarnations, and I was thinking in the sense that I was discussing with one devotee a long time ago that we also have many incarnations, so to speak, or personalities, like our greedy personality, or you said our cheating personality, our lusty, angry, greedy. We have multiple personalities, and that could cause conflicts between relationships. And I remember Terrence said, he made one good point. It was actually a joke, but it was actually a nice point. He said that sometimes our humble and gracious personality makes a cameo or a guest star in appearance, usually during a season finale. And so I thought this was an excellent
point. Something finale? What?
During a season, he was making like it's an episode. Oh, yeah. Okay. We have many personalities, many characters. And we could see that if we don't, my question is, what can we do to feature our humble and gracious personality in more episodes? Because we can see if we don't, then, you know, that could cause a lot of offenses and ruin a lot of relationships. Because this reminds me of what I was discussing with one devotee yesterday and another devotee a few weeks ago also. So can you elaborate on this point? I have some ideas in this regard, but maybe you'd like to elaborate on this point, because if we have more than one personality,
because of the, you know, the Hobbit examples coming to my mind, and we're talking about movies and stuff. You know, one of the main characters in The Hobbit, he had a problem with pride and being not humble, because he had a very difficult time submitting himself to the elves, because they were the only people that could help him get to, you know, to his quest, but he was so bitter or whatever because of the elves didn't help him with the dragon, because you know the dragon came and totally, you know, destroyed the dwarf kingdom or something, and the elves, they didn't help out, and so the dwarves are very bitter. They don't really get along well with the elves. But in order for this leader of the dwarves to be able to get his request. He needs to humble himself and, you know, like, come on, can you please help me? But he refused to do that, so then he ended up being locked up by the elves. And so pride always leads to some kind of, you know, downfall or something. So if we're trying to, so basically the question is how to increase humility and gratitude. I think those are the two qualities that you wanted to ask about coming to the forefront more. As far as knowledge is another thing. I mean, the thing is, if you get knowledge, you know, from the Shastras, and light shoved knowledge from Godhead, and then you try to contemplate that and, you know, try to apply these things in your life, these kind of things will come, because this dissipates the ignorance which comes from pride and arrogance and so many other things. Problem is we don't hear so well, or there's like this block. You know, even if we do hear, either we don't hear from the right source, or if we do hear from the right source, we don't process it properly. So therefore, we generally need some kind of spiritual master guidance to be able to process that knowledge and then be able to apply it in our lives, in such a way that we can develop humility and gratitude. Another practical way, at least as far as gratitude goes, is you can just, I've heard that you can try to see what other people do. Like if you're very inspired by some personality, then you can try to do what they do. And then once you try to do what they do, then you'll realize, wow, I can't believe everything they're doing. It's amazing. I'm so grateful for everything they're doing, because I try to do it and I realize how hard it is. So then when you try to do it, it's, wow, okay, gratitude arises in that other person who's been doing it for so long. So generally when we're kids, we don't have this gratitude so much. So even though our parents are doing so much for us, we're not really so grateful. Usually when, as we get older and we start doing things on our own, and, you know, maybe if we ourselves have kids or something like that, then we realize, wow, my parents did so much for me. And then a lot of times if they're good parents, then you become very, very grateful for everything your parents did for you. I know, like that, when I was, like, my parents forced me to play the violin. And I hated playing the violin when I was, at least I had to play when I was five. I, you know, they sat me down and they said, okay, Drew, you can play the violin, the cello, or the piano, take your pick. And I was like, I didn't really want to play any of them, but I had to choose, so I chose the violin because my brother was nearby. So I chose the violin, and so I started playing it, and then almost like every week I asked my mom, can I quit this? I don't want to do this. I'm terrible at it. I don't see the point. Of course, Prahlad doesn't think like that, do you? So I was the opposite of Prahlad. I did not want to do it. I hated it. But my mother forced me. She didn't care. She made me practice like an hour every day. And, you know. Because of that, I eventually got good at it. And now I'm a decent violinist. And then when I got into high school, I got pretty good. And then because I was pretty good, I was able to appreciate it more. My gratitude in being able to play violin, and therefore my gratitude to my mother greatly increased, because I was like, wow, I can't believe you forced me to continue doing this, even though I vehemently opposed it. Like, wow, thank you, Mom, for being so strong and not letting me quit. She always told me, you can quit when you're 18. So I was looking forward for that day so badly. I was like, I can't wait till I'm 18 so that I can quit this violin. But then a shift happened in between then and 18, and then I started liking it. Then I started wanting to go to symphony orchestra concerts. I went to go see Isaac Perlman. I thought it was the coolest. I got to travel to Japan with the string ensemble group. And I got to do so many things on account of being able to play the violin. And now my gratitude for my parents greatly increased. So as far as gratitude goes, one practical way to do it is you just try to do those things that were, you know, given to you. You might want to give them to somebody else, and then you are very grateful for what you have were given. So, just some thoughts.
Thank you. Those are very helpful. Do you mind if I make one other comment with some valid points you brought up between? Because this same point came up yesterday with one devotee. So all the points you were making, and basically what happens with all of us all the time is that, you know, he made the point that, you know, somebody, I felt disrespected me, and then I got revenge, and then he was thinking about, you know, I feel bad about it, you know, and needs to be more humble. So these things come up a lot. So this reminded me of one saying by one philosopher, I think Epictetus. He said, happiness, peace and happiness begin with the understanding of one basic principle. Some things are within our control and some things are not. And so then when I read these quotes, most of the time I read a lot of quotes, I understood that, you know, what's within our control is how we treat others. What's outside our control is how others treat us. And we usually try to control the latter. We try to make people respect us. And that's what I realized, you know, that's what causes most disharmony, is that we're always trying to force people to respect us or how we treat us. And the understanding that we made yesterday is that the final conclusion, I know this was helped me and was helped from the various lessons I learned from my various Diksha and Shiksha gurus, that it's impossible to be humble or tolerant or forgiving, because the point that was made between me and this devotee, we brought up the verse in the Gita in chapter 6 where Arjuna says, it is easier to control the wind than the mind. So in that sense, it's impossible. So my understanding is that what helps me out is that how important is Vandanam? See, we hear Shravanam Kirtana, Vishnu, and then that verse that says, Srimvatam Swakata Krishna. Krishna purify you of your heart from passion and ignorance if you're enthusiastic to hear Bhagavatam, etc. But how important is Vandanam, praying, like, before you get in a circumstance, like, Krishna, please let me be respectful of the Vaishnavas. Please let me honor the Vaishnavas. Please let me, tolerate whatever circumstances may come to me. How important is that? Because we realize it's impossible to control the mind in that sense. And we read in this previous verse that Krishna is the power of the senses, the mind, etc., from this previous verse in this seventh canto. So how important is Vandanam before we even get in a circumstance? You know, that's usually detrimental to ourselves and others. So can you speak about praying? Because Krishna knows English also. A lot of times we get in mechanically saying all the Sanskrit prayers without any thought up to them. But Krishna also knows English as well. So can you speak about that a little bit?
Well, prayer is one of the nine forms of devotional service. And that's actually the work that we have to do. We have to work on our prayer. and having that prayerful mood, that it's not, you know, having Krishna being in the center instead of us always being the subject in our thoughts. We pray and try to act in such a way that Krishna is the subject and we're his object, so we're asking him to please engage us in his devotional service. And then if we're always trying to, you know, work on thinking that way, being honest, offering prayers, first memorizing prayers. That's the first like step if you're wanting to get into increasing the quality of your prayers, is that you can first memorize them. There's so many wonderful prayers by our acharyas with wonderful moods and sentiments and expressions of devotion. And if, you know, you pick one that's attractive for you, that resonates with you, and then you just memorize it. And then you can pray it, you know, try it with whatever feeling you have. That's the first step. And then, you know, then you just try to, you know, you keep praying. Like, we know that famous story of Prabhupada. The devotee's asking Prabhupada, what, you know, I thought you said you could never fall down. Prabhupada said, well, yeah, and the reason why is because I'm praying all the time to Radha and Krishna, please don't let me fall down. And let me, please engage me in your loving devotional service and let me not fall into Maya. So, yeah, prayer is essential. If you don't feel like praying, or you're very stubborn and you really want to be proud and arrogant and whatever, you know, Krishna can send a big dragon to come and light you on fire, and you can learn that way. So you can either learn by hearing the Bhagavatam, trying to apply it in your life, or a dragon. So, okay, anything else?
I had a question. Did this pastime, is this on the Earth planet?
Here on this?
Yeah.
Well, I know it's in Satya Yuga. Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyakashipu was living in Indra's house, I believe. I think we heard that. He was living in the house of Indra, and Indra's planet is in the heavenly planets. He's got like a whole abode or something, you know, on top of Mount Meru, I think. You know, there's Brahma. Well, there's Brahmaloka on top of Mount Meru, but I think Indra has a place near there. That's where Indra's place is, on the 7th or 8th circle of Bhumandala. I didn't know that. So Indra lives near those elephants? Oh, but does... Where did you hear that Indra lives out? Because I thought, I could have swore I remember that one of... Because, you know, the picture, if you've seen the Sacred Universe video, there's the Mount Meru, and then Brahmaloka's on the top of it, and there's all these, like, 7 or 8, like, cities or whatever. And I think one of those is Indra's, no? Really? So they have a residence on top of Mount Meru. Or they have a... What do you call it? They live, perhaps, on... You know, in these concentric circles. But then they have something... Some residence or some kind of outpost or something on top of Brahmaloka. So I'm guessing this must then apply. So then what, this happened in the seven circles, seventh or eighth? Oh, okay. So this happened in Indraloka, which is on the seventh or eighth concentric circle of Bhumandala. So that's where this is happening. Yeah, but it's not happening on planet Earth.
I always just wonder, like, if Nrisimhadeva is so big, or like in Krishna's pastimes, these such big demons, like, doesn't everything just get destroyed? Because they just like walk on, like, their head hits the sky.
Yeah.
Like, don't they just like trample everything? Like the whole world's just like done. But that makes sense that it's not on the Earth.
Yeah, it helps explain a lot of things. Otherwise, this is really far out stuff.
Questions in regards to Lord Brahma receiving the Vedic knowledge. I was wondering which particular event that is, because we know that he goes into meditation for, I think, 100 years. Is that correct?
I don't remember however many years, but for some time.
100 celestial years, but that's also, I thought, the duration of his life. And then he hears the sound tapa, and he goes and he meditates. And then, after doing that for that amount of time, then he knowledge is revealed. But do you remember how that happened? Did the Lord speak to Brahma?
I don't know all the details. Do you know, Prahlad?
Krishna played his flute, and the knowledge went from his flute into Brahma's ears.
This was after he did the tapasya, or?
After.
So after tapasya, Krishna...
Have you seen that painting?
I've seen the painting, but I didn't know if that happened after the tapasya, or when. He heard the sound of Krishna's flute, and from that sound, all of the knowledge, dharma, artha, karma, kama, moksha, came into his heart, and he was enlightened that way. And then he spoke Brahma Samhita.
So Brahma Samhita is the original Vedic knowledge?
should say that.
Like there's some pastime. I think it might be early in this canto when Hiranyakashipu starts speaking transcendental knowledge about the soul, and he gives this story. I think the young boy starts speaking all this, and everyone can listen to him because he's a young boy. And I was thinking this past time, we understand it's basically a lila that Krishna wants to enjoy the fighting spirit, so he orchestrated the whole thing, Jai and Vijay come into the material world. So we think, you know, Jai, that's awesome, there's someone to fight with the Lord. But then also we see how much destruction and chaos and murdering and all these things that these demons actually performed. And I wonder if that, obviously, the Lord, that was also part of his plan, but it seems like, and this is probably a materialistic consideration, but it seems like a large expense for the Lord to get his fighting pastime. Couldn't he have done that without creating this havoc throughout the whole universe? I mean, one can't really ask that question. But you see my point that I'm saying, it's, there's such a negative reaction from these demons also. That must have also been part of the Lord's plan.
Yeah, the Lord has a plan, and when the Lord does things, he accomplishes multiple things he usually kills two birds with one stone. Of course, doesn't kill birds really, but he does multiple things with different actions that he does. So then, you know, he might. You know, in order for him to enjoy his fighting spirit and at the same time perhaps let people live out their karma, for example, he might arrange things in such a way that those who were destined to suffer because of whatever their previous reactions or misdeeds were, they would be in that situation. They would be perhaps maybe in that time when demons were causing so much trouble. So then they'd get their reactions, but at the same time then the Lord would be able to, you know, have his fighting spirit and be the hero. So both are accomplished.
Okay, and in regards also to this process of the four defects and everything, so it's impossible to receive perfect knowledge through the ascending process. That's what you're hearing. Mm-hmm. It's actually impossible.
Well, knowledge which is beyond the perception of the senses is impossible. Only through the ascending process. Because that's what you
now,
use to...
And what about in the case of someone like Dhruva Maharaj, where he was given a particular process?
And well, that's the thing, is Dhruva Maharaj and others, they had some connection with Shabda. So it was actually a descending process. You know, we heard how it described is that first you... The way the descending process works is that you get some kind of shabda, some knowledge, or process, or something, and then you kind of, it's like the opposite. Ascending is you perceive something with your senses, you think about it, and then you come to some kind of knowledge. The descending process is the opposite, where you start with some kind of knowledge, shabda, or something, which he had from Narada Muni in some way, and then you think about it, and then you can actually perceive it and realize it.
So, I guess I'm thinking in the case of something like mystic yoga or practice, like where it's largely done through meditation, where through one's own efforts to some degree, one is taking up a process by which from a contaminated consciousness, they're doing some activity that's leading them to a state of greater and greater purity, and then almost as if on their own, they're able to awaken through meditation, Paramatma realization, things like this.
So well, it's, we hear that for any process to work, especially to the point of Paramatma realization, there needs to be a tinge of bhakti. Bhakti has to be in there somewhere for anything to work. So, you know, these mystic processes for gaining, or processes for gaining mystic powers and stuff, you might be able to do that on a material level. You know, you might be able to get certain powers and stuff. You might be successful in that way, but in order to experience or do anything beyond this, the perception of the senses, something beyond material, so to speak, there needs to be some, like, bhakti has to be in the process somehow. Some shabda from some pure source has to be there somewhere along the lines. Some devotee has to be involved in the process somehow. Either the devotee giving the knowledge or somebody serving a devotee, or somehow bhakti has to be introduced into that process for it to work, otherwise it won't bear any results, like eternal results, such as seeing Paramatma. Is that okay?
Okay, so also there's this Brahmin who's reading Bhagavad Gita upside down. He was doing that on the order of his guru, but it's not that he was specifically receiving. We don't know actually his history, but it seems that through his sincerity, then Krishna was revealing everything. Not that he was actually understanding or reading Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, but he put his effort into it. And yeah, we don't know the history, so we can't say so much about that particular case. So we don't know what led him to that state of being able to just become so absorbed in Bhagavad Gita just by thinking about Krishna being Arjuna's chariot driver, but you know, there's always, you know, there's a whole scientific process to get there, at least for us. I mean, some people might get that mercy or, you know, special mercy to be able to do something, but generally there's a process to be able to come to that point of being able to have, you know, real devotional sentiments for Krishna.
One last question I was going to ask also, that discussion. The ascending process through the Upanishads, through the process of Gyan, where one does negation through mental speculation, one can arrive at Brahman realization, which is, in one sense, a realization of the Absolute Truth. So that ascending process by negation, using the mind and the intelligence, the intellect, we were saying earlier that one cannot receive perfect knowledge, but through that process, one can reach the stage of Brahman realization.
I don't remember hearing that. Only by the process of negation you can come to Brahman realization. I haven't heard that. I would have to.
That's generally how the Gyanis, they engage in the process of neti-neti, which means they're using
their only process, though? Or
their intellect.
Is that their only process?
Well, that's the main one, by studying the Vedas many, many hours every day.
Well, studying, you know, the Vedas, that's different than just neti-neti. Neti-neti is, you know, everything that has variety and differentiation and, like, duality or whatever, it leads to some kind of suffering or something. So that therefore that must not be the Absolute Truth. And then they just say what the Absolute Truth is not. I don't know if that's necessary. But then if they're studying the Vedas and they're trying to understand the Vedas, that's different. That's like a more positive approach. So then, maybe those gyanis that only do neti-neti, I haven't heard that they would come to, they would be able to only by through that process they'd be coming to the state of Brahman realization. Perhaps if they're trying to understand the Vedas, and they may also use neti-neti, but they're really trying to understand the Vedas, then perhaps I could see that.
I kind of answered my own question, because generally, but that is, they would be studying those portions of the Vedas that deal with this Upanishadic school. But by doing so, they are hearing Shabda.
That's right.
And that's allowing them to properly guide their intellect. Perform that process.
Yeah. That's nice. Okay. That's it. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.